Welcome to The Sound of Economics. My name is Guntram Wolf and I'm the director of Bruegel. And in today's director's cut, I'm joined by Ms. Maha Yaha. She is the director at the Carnegie Middle East Center in Lebanon, in Beirut, based in Beirut. She has a PhD in social sciences from MIT and in urban planning from the University of London, and is an expert in the Middle East and has published numerous papers on migration in particular, but on many other issues as well. And we want to discuss about the situation in Syria and what the Syrian situation means in terms of refugees, perhaps also the return of refugees, but also the reconstruction of Syria once the war is over, and what should be Europe's role in all of this. Well, perhaps, Maha, let me start by first welcoming you.
Thank you for having me on this podcast.
Thank you, Maha. And so perhaps just to kick us off, can you tell us a little bit about where do you see the situation in Syria currently? Is the war ending? Is Assad winning? And what does it all mean?
The war is at least the primary conflict that, or the civil conflict in Syria is definitely ending. Assad is regaining territory and regaining ground. However, now what is taking precedence is the secondary conflicts, i.e. the conflicts between the regional and international powers. And this is where it gets messier and more. And this is the conflict around the borders of Syria. So you have the Turkish Euphrates Shield in the north. You have the international coalition and the areas that they're kind of in control of, along with the Kurds in the northeast. So, and then there is the, well, it's no longer, I mean, the regime has regained territories in the southern parts of Syria, but there are also a lot of international interests in that area, primarily by Israel, Iran, and Jordan. So the idea that the war itself is ending, I think, is false. Yes, the civil conflict has decreased to a great degree. Assad and the regime of Bashar al-Assad has regained control over much of the territory. But the secondary parts of the conflict are far from over. And I think they are much more complicated in terms of the vested interests of all the different actors that are involved in this particular parts of the conflict itself.
Okay, but if I understand you correctly, the core territory of Syria might very soon become more peaceful, so that the conditions for refugees returning and reconstruction of the territory of all the cities that were so terribly bombed are in place. So will the conditions be in place that in perhaps a year or two the work of reconstruction can restart and refugees can come back?
The idea that the parts of Syria, that Syria itself, the core parts of Syria are becoming more peaceful, is based on the assumption that Assad can maintain control over these territories. The regime of Bashar al-Assad today is facing a number of challenges. One of those challenges is considerable, if you want, attrition in human resources that it is facing. The other challenge is the multiple militias that have emerged during the conflict and that are operating across different parts of Syria. There are many others. There's the international interventions, the foreign and non-state actors. I mean, there are lots of factors on the ground that make it very difficult to see how this is going to be a peaceful operation. The regime itself cannot govern under the current conditions. Above and beyond this, it doesn't have the financial resources to do the kind of reconstruction that is needed and the rebuilding that is needed to rebuild actually areas that it barrel bombed itself. The third part is, in many aspects, it has now to deal with a population that is very polarized. Every indication it is giving is that the regime is not interested in having people come back. What it is interested in is in rewarding its own loyalists. And I'll give a few examples to explain what I mean. In the past couple of years, there have been a new legislative framework that is being put in place. Anyone who wants to go back to Syria has to go through a very opaque vetting mechanism that is not clear to anyone who vets and how they're vetted, but people are vetted through a number of different security agencies, and often they're not allowed to go back. For as one example, in the summer, about 3,000 refugees wanted to go back from Lebanon to Syria. Of the 3,000, only 400 were allowed to return, and those 400 were mainly women, children, and the elderly. So this gives you just a small sense of the extent to which the regime does not want people back.
Can I push you a little bit more on this, perhaps before we talk about the sense of the regime wanting refugees back, that just that we recap to our listeners the scale of the issue. So how many people have fled Syria, and what is your perhaps best estimate of how many want to come back? The 3,000 is a very small number compared, of course, to the actual numbers. Perhaps you can just walk our listener through the actual number of people that have left Syria during the war.
There are about 5 to 6 million people who have left Syria, who fled the country. Of those, there's about 1 million in Lebanon. A country, a population of 4 million, has another 1 million refugees. There's another 600 to 700,000, these are UN estimates, based in Jordan. And then there's another 2.5 million in Turkey, and the rest fled to Europe. To give a sense of how many people want to go back, it's very difficult. But we did a study last year, and it came out in a publication called Unheard Voices. It was based on field work with refugees in Lebanon and Jordan. What I can say, based on that sample and the focus group discussions we had, is that the majority of people want to go back. However, they are worried about their safety. They're worried about the safety of their children, about their ability to lead any kind of life. What they will tell you is that we are willing to go and live on our land and do bread with our own hands if there are any kind of guarantees that we will be safe and secure. They do not believe they will be safe and secure under the current regime. These are people who fled the regime. They fled the barrel bombs. They fled assassinations, killings. I mean, the most atrocious kinds of violence you can imagine. So their sense of wanting to go back is incredibly strong. Their belief that they will be able to go back is very weak. They're very worried about their future. They know they have no future in the countries where they've sought refuge. And they're sort of stuck in limbo because they know they can neither go back nor are they able to build lives where they are. And it's heartbreaking in many ways because we're talking about millions of people, children who are really, truly a lost generation. If this is not dealt with very quickly, whether through, and we can talk about what Europe can do and others can do, both in terms of supporting refugees where they are in their countries of refuge, making sure that they have, particularly for children, that they have the proper health, education, but also the possibility of leading dignified lives and being productive members of society rather than being forced to depend on aid indefinitely. There's a lot that can be done in these areas, whether it's in Europe or in frontline countries such as Lebanon, Jordan, and Turkey. So I think just to give a sense, within Syria, there's another 6.7 million who have been displaced from their homes, within Syria itself, who've been displaced from their homes. So for refugees who are outside the country, again, the idea of going back, so they move from one refugee camp to another, is also another challenge. Refugees are very concerned about questions of accountability. And justice. It's not just guarantees of their safety on the ground, the safety of their children, but also who will be held accountable and by whom. They are aware, and they're very aware, that you cannot hold everyone accountable. So they'll tell you, we're okay with not holding the person who stole my house or bombed my house accountable. But the person who killed my father, I want to see him in prison. They're very worried about revenge killings. They're very worried about the lawlessness with all the different militias running around. There are new power dynamics on the ground that we're not aware of in different areas and villages. People want to go back to their homes. They can't go back to their homes of origin because many of these homes have been destroyed. The scale of the destruction in Syria, particularly in the areas where the refugees came from, is in the order of several billion. This is as per World Bank estimates. So it's going to take Syria decades, if anything. And this would have been under the rosy scenario of some sort of a political settlement, some sort of a transition. It would have taken Syria many, many, many years to get back on track. Under these current conditions, I think it will take much longer for refugees to be able to go back, if they are ever allowed to go back. So this is from the kind of figures and the perspective, but also this tale of devastation is just amazing. Just to give one figure, I think that will give a sense of the medical health sector, only 15% of doctors, this is WHO figures, only 15% of doctors and nurses remain in Syria today. There are about 2 million children who are out of school. There was a deliberate targeting of the health sector and of the education sector during the conflict. So what are people being asked to go back to? What kind of lives are they expected to lead in these places? And who will guarantee their safety and security? The most basic thing that any parent would want for their children if they were to go back.
So very clearly, the will to go back depends on safety and security, but I guess it also depends on the economic prospects that the country can offer. And you mentioned already the scale of the devastation of the infrastructure, of housing, of schools, of also key infrastructures, including hospitals and so on, that don't exist anymore. So perhaps we can talk a little bit about this gigantic task of rebuilding Syria, which sounds very nice when you say it like this, but which seems almost an impossible task, even if you had a perfectly run Syrian government. Can you give us a sense, sort of, suppose we had some sort of stability, some political stability in the country? What would it take really to rebuild the country? I mean, how much money from outside do you think should be flowing into Syria? Where should it flow to? How should it be channeled? But also beyond the money, how much technical expertise would be needed? How much technical assistance perhaps should be foreseen? So how would you go about this business of rebuilding Syria?
I think rebuilding Syria, it's maybe even premature to be talking about this, because any reconstruction, this is not a technical issue. This is a political issue par excellence. If we want to think of anything to be done in Syria today, we have to recognize that reconstruction is a very political process. The idea that there might be a Marshall Plan for the rebuilding of Syria, I think, is out. There is the central government neither has the capacity nor the financial will, nor the, if you want, the kind of interest to really rebuild across Syrian territory. We're already seeing in some of the reconstruction activities that the government itself is undertaking, how selective it is in the areas that it is kind of targeting for reconstruction. It's mainly in areas that are known to have been loyal, areas that were loyal to the regime, geographic areas that were loyal to the regime. And this is not necessarily based on identity politics. It's simply geographically areas that were loyal to the regime, or areas where the regime has a strategic interest to maintain control over. So the idea of a Marshall Plan, where, you know, there is a centrally led process for the rebuilding of all the country, would have been possible had there been a more inclusive governance structure that would allow for something like this. Under the current conditions, that is not feasible. What I think we're looking at is a very piecemeal rebuilding process that will be very localized and that will be undertaken by the regime in places where it thinks it has a strategic interest in having people that are loyal to it go back. In other places, we're seeing, under the guise of reconstruction in a place like Damascus, for example, in the last year, there are new urban development laws that have been initiated, a number of laws. This is, again, the changing legal framework that is facilitating the dispossession of Syrians from their own property. Law number 10 is the one that became, gained a lot of attention in Europe, particularly because it basically said anybody who cannot prove ownership would have their property expropriated by force from them. And there, I won't get into the technicalities of it, but it's a very problematic law. It really facilitates the dispossession of Syrians from their own properties. However, there's a body of other laws that also do the same thing. Under this guise, there's now a new urban development in Damascus that has emerged in the last 2 years. It's being constructed by businessmen who were in support of the regime. And it is taking place in informal areas that were opposition strongholds. Whereas other informal areas that were not opposition strongholds have not been, that were loyal to the regime, have not been touched. So the regime is using, it's politicizing that process even more than it actually is at that point. What I see moving forward, in the absence of any funding flowing from the international community, and I think it's incredibly difficult for the international community today to provide funding to a regime that has been accused of war crimes and crimes against humanity because of the implications on international justice systems, on questions of accountability, the entire norms on which our international frameworks are based. So what I see moving forward is probably piecemeal rebuilding in selective areas that are of strategic interest to the regime. Should European policymakers, and I know that this is a big debate in Brussels today in terms of we need to recognize the reality of the regime as one and we have to normalize, and by normalizing we can give money and then refugees will return. That's a pipe dream. Any money that is given to the regime under the current conditions, unless there are incredibly strong and clear conditionalities that say European donors have the right to know where the money is going, how it's being spent, who it's being given to, which areas it's being spent, and they can actually direct this process, then that money will simply go flow into through different agencies, through different NGOs that are aligned with the regime, and they will go to just support the regime in one way or the other.
Well, let's walk a little bit more through the European response. I mean, what should the European Union be doing? You already alluded to the fact that there is a discussion in Brussels that perhaps we have to just recognize the reality. Assad is winning, so let's work with him. To help rebuild the country, but also to, of course, that's the prime interest in Europe, to make sure that refugees can go back. And I can certainly say, coming from Germany, that the issue of refugees is and remains the politically most sensitive and most toxic discussion in the German public debate. And I think many in many quarters, of course, of the German political system would be, and the population at large would be very happy that refugees that I think when they came were genuinely welcomed as seeking shelter, seeking help from this terrible war. Once the war is over, I think the logic is very clear. We would be very happy if they come back to their country. If they go back to their country of origin and also, frankly speaking, help rebuild the country, help rebuild the society. I mean, all the human capital that is here, all the expertise and so on. I mean, in principle, these people need to be in their country of origin and need to be rebuilding their country. So I guess the question is, what can European Union, the member states, really do? You already mentioned tough conditionality. We know that conditionality can work, but it can also fail. So how would you go about, and how, what also perhaps give us a sense of the order of magnitude? I mean, what kind of amounts would you think would be useful and can usefully be given with strict conditionality? Are we talking here of hundreds of millions? Are we talking of billions? What would be your take? I mean, how would you go about it?
The reconstruction needs of Syria are in the billions. Sure. So how much Europe can give to make a meaningful, the more it gives, obviously, the more meaningful impact it can have, and the more
if it's spent well, that's so the question is how much can you give so that it is spent well?
Well,
I mean,
that,
with conditionality.
That's not a question that I think, at least for me, from my perspective, it's very hard to say. You know, if you give 100 million or 1 billion, it's better than giving 2 billion or 200. It's very difficult to do these kinds of estimates. Now, I hear you on the idea that if the war is over, therefore people can go back and rebuild. Again, this is based on the assumption that the war is over and that Syria is welcoming its refugees back. This is not happening. This is simply not happening. We've seen stories now of people who have chosen to go back from Lebanon again and Jordan, back to the areas that they came from, and there are multiple stories emerging of them being arrested, killed, disappeared in many different locations. Not only that, but in areas in the south where the regime took over, for example, a place like Daraa, which was one of the first flashpoints of the uprising. And let's not forget, this was a peaceful uprising in 2011. The regime took over, you know, recaptured the entire south through a negotiation with the Russians. Once the Russian monitors pulled out, civil activists who chose to stay in Daraa, civil activists, we're not talking about people who took up arms, are also being harassed, disappeared, and sent into prison. So we need to, again, move away from the idea that Syria is open for business and safe for people to go back.
But what could conditionality achieve? So you give, how much money would Assad change his behavior and his regime change his behavior with strict conditionality linked to money?
What the Assad regime is saying now, he does not want funding from the international regime because he knows that he is politicizing the refugee issue and using it as a bargaining chip with frontline countries such as Lebanon and Jordan, but also with other countries. With Lebanon, for example, if you normalize with us, we will allow people back. But then when they want to go back, we don't let them go back because our vetting system doesn't allow them to go back. So the idea that, I say that conditionalities are important for Europe to make sure that its money is well spent and for European policymakers. This doesn't mean that the Assad regime is going to accept them. The Assad regime from day one refused Geneva and did not want to acknowledge Geneva because they did not want any kind of international oversight of any political transition, of any peace process that takes place. So for me, we are in a conundrum in the sense that we can neither give money to reinforce a regime and support a regime that is in good conscience, that, as I said, has been accused of crimes against humanity. But at the same time, if money is going to be provided under conditions that make it possible for European policymakers to say we've done our homework, the regime will not accept them. So I don't see a way out of this. I think we need to shift away from thinking about refugee return and think more strategically in terms of what does it mean when we talk about global frameworks? What kind of global architecture today is needed? I mean, we're focusing a lot on the refugee issue from Syria, but the issue of migration and refugees is much bigger than Syria. The largest portion is coming from Syria. So maybe we need to shift our thinking in terms of talking about global burden sharing, responsibilities. What kind of global architecture is important today so that it's not only Germany that is bearing the big burden of, even though when you look at the numbers, it's not, I mean, Lebanon, it's 1 million out of 4 million. So one in every, you have one refugee for every four Lebanese in the country. So we need to look at this in terms of a much larger perspective. We also need to recognize that if this is not dealt with, in a way that really recognizes the needs of these people, it will come back to haunt us because we're going to be creating a situation where, as I said, you have an entire lost generation of Syrian children who will be very vulnerable to all kinds of exploitation down the road. So it's in our security interest to make sure that if people were to go back, they go back. And this happens by insisting on a political settlement. by insisting on a political settlement that is recognizes the needs of people who were that actually places accountability at the center of that political settlement, which means holding the regime accountable for actions committed during the war. This might sound like a pipe dream, but again,
that's the only way.
I don't see any other way. I think that any kind of political settlement under the conditions today, giving money under the conditions today, is actually, again, rewarding crimes against humanity, but more importantly, or not more importantly, but also creating an unsustainable, it's guaranteeing that Syria will remain an epicenter of insecurity for a very long time to come, not only for its region, but also for Europe and beyond.
Well, I think we could go on for a long time. I certainly take away that nothing is solved, really, and that we need to shift our thinking perhaps beyond Syria and emphasize also on the financial side, emphasize perhaps the support that countries like Lebanon, but perhaps even Turkey, and of course other recipient countries of refugees need. So perhaps there is a need to enlarge the framework. But I think you also made a very strong point that as long as the regime is there and is not held accountable, the willingness of refugees to go back will be extremely limited. And so I think we as European policymakers probably need to realize that a lot of the refugees that are in our countries will stay for quite some time in our countries. And I guess then that shifts the priority then to measures of helping in the integration process, basically, and you know, putting even more resources than currently into the integration into our society. So de facto, these refugees become parts of our societies for a very long time. And so I think that's also an important policy conclusions for policymakers.
I agree. I think integration is fundamentally important, but I think also making sure that ordinary Germans who are perhaps are challenged on multiple fronts also benefit. It's about integration programs. One of the problems we saw in Lebanon, for example, is that host communities were very resentful. Why is the money going only to refugees when we also need? So I think integrating refugees into their frameworks, making sure they learn the language, they're part of the culture, they're welcomed. All of this is important. They're part of educational systems. This is a human capital that countries can capitalize on. Yesterday in the U.S. midterm election, there's a young Somalian refugee who just became the first female congresswoman, a refugee congresswoman in the United States. These people have a lot to contribute to their communities and to their societies, and think the more we can build on this, the better for everyone.
Okay, I think this would be yet another discussion that could take us another half an hour. But I think it's time to conclude this podcast. Thank you so much for joining us today, Maha. It was great to discuss with you today. Thank you.
A pleasure. Thank you, Gunther. It was a pleasure to be here.